In 2009, I was a dead broke real estate agent that hated my life, and I wanted to find a way to make money online so I could travel. Ultimately, we launched our website and kind of our full product suite in like August, September of 2016. I've been to 40 countries over the last 14 years as I've been traveling and working online. And Thailand was one of my favorites. I spent 9 months there.
Alrighty, thank you guys so much for coming today on Ecom Verified. Have a really awesome guest that I'm looking forward to interviewing with you guys so that we can learn from the best of the best. As you guys know, I'm always looking for Ecom founders that have found success, that know what they're talking about and can pass on that knowledge to the rest of the brands and everyone else that's trying to accomplish what they have accomplished. Today, we have Anthony Mink here today from Live Bearded. Just to give a quick little intro of him, he is the CEO and co-founder of Live Bearded. It's a D2C men's grooming brand that helps bearded men look fresh and be at their best. They created this company with his best friend, Spencer Davis, that they've been around for a long time, since 2016, if I'm not mistaken. And they've grown it to an eight-figure business with over 60,000 five-star reviews. Wild. Absolutely wild. Anthony, thank you so much for coming today.
Yeah, brother. I really appreciate you reaching out. It's been awesome to get to connect and learn a little bit about what you're doing and the podcast. And, you know, I'd say the one thing I'm most passionate about in life, two things. One, travel, and business. Those are like my two biggest passions, and I've found a way to integrate the two. But I've really, you know, as I've grown the business over the last couple of years and kind of stepped into different roles as an entrepreneur, you know, one of the things that I've enjoyed the most is just giving back to the community and sharing with people that are on the journey on the way up. You know, when I got started, it was 2010, 2011. Facebook ads were brand new. And this whole idea of like working online, you know, being a quote digital nomad, like that term didn't even exist when I got started 13, 14 years ago. So I just love talking about the game of business, sharing strategies and insights that I've learned on my journey in the hopes that it can help inspire others on theirs. So it's a pleasure to be here with you today, brother.
Yeah, I love that. Education is so fun, and it's awesome to be able to invest in people in that way. And travel is one of my biggest passions. So we might even talk about some of that today, just so that we can jam on that. I got into this as well so that I could, you know, travel and work at the same time. I hated going to offices. I hated having to show up somewhere, and being able to travel and work is one of the best things ever. So where are like some of the places you like to go?
Yeah, so I'm heading off to Hawaii in a couple of days. I actually got a place down there that I've rented. So I spent half my time in Arizona, half my time in Maui. The phase of the business that I'm in, I have to stay highly productive as we're really trying to grow the business and the team's expanding. So like between Arizona and Maui works very well for me, but I'm going to spend the month of December in Australia. I try to go to Europe every summer. I feel like the summer on the Mediterranean is just like a whole different vibe. Yeah. But in my travels, you know, I've been to 40 countries over the last 14 years as I've been traveling and working online. And, you know, Thailand was one of my favorites. I spent 9 months there. I went on safari in Africa. I loved it so much. I went back a few months later, went on a second one. So for me, man, I'm a sucker for the beach. I'm a beach boy at heart. And I love to find just like the best, softest sanded beaches with like the most beautiful blue turquoise water. And I find that it gives me the perspective I need and the disconnect from the day-to-day kind of chaos of running a business to like calm my mind a little bit and actually think, you know, maybe about the business in a different way from a different vantage point. And my favorite thing to do, I'm curious if you do this, but when I travel, I'm reading all the time. I'm like listening to books. I'm thinking through problems in the business. So it's almost like the brain never 100% turns off. Maybe it does for a few days. You know, you give yourself that 3 or 4 day complete reset. But then after that, man, I'm writing, I'm journaling. I might not be on my computer as much, but I feel like the separation from the environment or from the day-to-day operations of the business is really what allows me to kind of come up with the next level of growth, the next strategy, the next insight that we can kind of take it to the next level. But for me, man, the travel has been, it was for sure the reason why I wanted to start a business online in the first place. And it's been one of my greatest teachers. I could talk about it for hours. I love it, but it's amazing.
Yeah, one of my good friends and mentors, he always says that life is kind of like a video game. And when you travel, it's like going to different spots on the map that unlock side quests and data sets in your mind that help you view your business and just life in general in a different way, and helps you make changes and think of things that you wouldn't have thought about if you were just sitting in your office all day.
I think it's so true, you know, and part of that is when you just get out of your environment, you tap into a different energy, you mm-hmm. know, and you're meeting new people, you're seeing new things. I love to just go and, you know, being in retail, although it's digital retail, right? D2C, like we're still shopping and or we're still providing a shopping experience to the end consumer. And I love just going to local boutiques and shops and different places wherever I'm at and looking at how people are marketing and selling and positioning. I think there's like that direct apples to apples comparison. But to your point of just like going and unlocking a new quest or a new set of skills by having a different experience, I think, it's so critical. And I think one of the best things that I could, you know, tell any entrepreneur out there is find what that thing is for you that really fills you up and helps you reset. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be the family, it might be sports or going to the game or a movie, like whatever it is. I think it's so critical that we understand ourselves as founders, because if I'm a big fan of Dan Martell, and I was listening to him recently, and he said, as a founder of a company, you are your greatest asset and also the company's greatest liability.
Yeah.
If you as the founder decide one day you don't want to do this thing, then everyone on your team is fucked. And all your customers are left high and dry. And so it was this idea of like, you have to find out what it is that refuels you, that motivates you, that drives you. And then you need to invest time and energy into that thing so that you can come back to the business and be your best self. And I think it's taken me a long time to like really figure out that balance. But if you have big goals and you want to build a big business or a business that's on a, you know, good growth trajectory, you're going to hit burnout. You got to find that way to replenish.
For sure. What's your favorite places to visit in the Mediterranean?
That's so tough, man. Like Barcelona, Spain, I went to Mallorca last year. So I just love Spain in general. Like I love the Spanish vibe. Being a single guy, it's a fun place to go. Greece is great. I also really love Turkey. Like it's kind of up there more in the Eastern European side, but I got the privilege to spend a few weeks in Turkey a couple years ago, and the people were so kind and generous. It was, I just had such a great time. Italy. I mean, I feel like you can't go wrong, but I've been to Spain probably like 4 times at this point. So I tend to keep finding my way back there. I've been to Greece a few times. So I don't know that I have one spot. I just like, you know, you go get a little bit different culture, a little bit different food. And once you're over there, it's easy to bounce around.
Yeah, for sure. You gotta check out Croatia. That's one of my favorite countries in the world right now.
Amazing. So I did a sailing trip through there a few years ago, but I was just on the boat the whole time. And so we didn't really get out and experience too much of the country. So I definitely want to make it happen.
Yeah, it's a sick place. I actually just got married there in May, but it's one of my favorite countries. It's incredible.
Dude, that's amazing. Congrats.
Crystal clear water, like everything that you were talking about, incredible food. And they have a lot of influence from Italy as far as their food goes, because they used to be run by the Venetians. So like, some of the best pastas, some of the best pizzas you'll ever have. But it's an awesome place to visit.
I love that, man. I'm going to hit it up next year for sure.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right, now diving more into the brand side of things, because that's, you know, that's what the people want to hear. They don't want to hear about our traveling. how did it all start? So how did Live Beer just start? Was that your first brand? What got you into it?
Yeah, so in 2009, I was a dead broke real estate agent that hated my life, and I wanted to find a way to make money online so I could travel. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I started buying books, training courses, anything I could get my hands on back in 2009. Long story short, I took a course on paid media. I started buying Facebook ads kind of late 2010, early 2011, and started to have some success in the affiliate marketing game. So I ran a bunch of affiliate campaigns for a few years. Ultimately started my first e-commerce business back in 2013. It was a sports merchandise site, ran that for a year, sold that to a competitor, started a couple of other businesses, just smaller affiliate sites, ended up selling those. And then ultimately just got to a point where I was, you know, I dabbled in a few different things online, from affiliate to e-commerce to I had a couple media properties. And I was really just exploring what I wanted to do. And ultimately the thing that made the most sense to me was I wanted to build an asset and I wanted to be able to create something that I could sell in the future. And I was friends with Ezra Firestone. I was in kind of his e-commerce mastermind group really like in the early days when it first got started. So that side of the business in terms of like what you could do online made the most sense to me. It was some tangible. And I started doing research and figuring out what product do I want to start. I knew from my affiliate days that I wanted to talk to dudes. I'm a dude and I speak dude. And it was just easier to write copy than it would be to like try to sell to women or anybody else. And so I wanted to sell a product that I would use myself so I could just be the avatar and I could just work and talk to people and build a community of men. That's kind of where Spencer enters the picture. Him and I met at the time. We'd been friends for about 10 years. We'd always talked about business and doing different things. And he was growing out his beard, No Shave November, in 2015. And he's like, dude, you ever thought about selling beard products? Like, I know you're trying to look for this opportunity in men and whatnot. And, you know, maybe beards are a good market to go after. I feel like the trend's really popular. And at the time, I just had some scruff. Like I didn't even think I could grow a beard, to be honest with you. And he had this handlebar mustache and this glorious beard. And I, one thing led to another and we decided to partner on it. And I was like, you're going to be the face of the brand and the product expert. So like he had no experience with digital marketing, didn't really know anything about it. So I was like, I want you to be the face of the brand.
He just had beard experience. Every one of our
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's really where it started. And then from there, I'm a fan of like minimum viable product tests. Like how do you prove your proof of concept? Mm-hmm. And so we ordered 500 wooden beard combs from Alibaba. I got a logo designed for $500. I had them stamp it on the wood combs and literally the wood combs sat in my living room for like a month and a half. We finally put together this super simple free plus shipping funnel. And my whole goal was, can I give these things away for free? If someone's willing to like pay for shipping and then we had some upsells and stuff, that would give us an indicator of success. And then obviously looking at like advertising metrics, click-through rates, just overall engagement rates on the marketing. And we ended up selling all 500 combs in like a day and a half. It was like a $2 CPA, you know? And so next thing you know, we're like, how the fuck are we going to ship out 500 combs? Like we're sitting in our living room. And to this day, I have pictures of Spence and I literally licking and sticking envelopes in my living room. And after 500, we're like, okay, there's something here, you know, like let's order 10,000 of them and see if we can like take the business, kind of continue to keep expanding on it. And in the early days, all we cared about was getting a proof of concept and then community feedback. Mm-hmm. So we launched a Facebook group. And anybody who bought a comb from us, we invited them to join the group. And Spencer literally spent the first 6 months just connecting with everyone in the group. Hey, you know, why did you buy? How long have you had your beard? What products do you use? What do you not like? What do you want? Et cetera, et cetera. And we used a lot of that real-time customer feedback to go to a manufacturer to design our first products. That's awesome. And then ultimately, we launched our website and kind of our full product suite in like August, September of 2016. Mm-hmm. So we started beginning of 2016, kind of dabbling with the idea November 2015. So about a year later, we had products, we had a website, and we kind of like hit the ground running and haven't really looked back since. You know, I thought it was going to be this small little beard business that I built up with a friend for fun. And, you know, now it's grown into, as you mentioned, an 8-figure company. We got 22 employees and an office and a warehouse, and it's turned into something a little bit bigger than I thought it would be. But it's been an amazing ride. And it truly all started with us reaching out to people that were interested in our product and just getting to know them and saying, what do you guys want? What are you using? Why do you buy products? And what would you like if you could design your own product? And then taking that feedback. And honestly, I'd say that's one of the things that I'm most proud of. And I think in the world we live in today, especially in D2C, everybody wants the hack. They want the easy thing. They want the scalable AI tool or this or that. But where you win is when you do the unscalable thing. And for us, that was like reaching out to customers and figuring out what they wanted. And at every iteration of the business, whether it was, okay, what are product line extensions or what about new fragrances or we're going to rebrand and relaunch some things, we've surveyed our top customers every step of the way and said, what products do you want next? What do you like? What do you not like? Where can we improve? And to the best of our ability, we've taken that direct feedback and implemented it into the business. And I'm very proud of that because ultimately now I know that we have a business that is not, it's not successful because I'm so smart or Spencer's right. so smart, but because we've collaborated with the actual end consumer and got their input along the way. And as you would find out, people like to buy from a company that they feel like is taking their input and putting it into place. Yeah. And so we've really cultivated this amazing community of men that have rallied around the brand and have helped us grow to where we are.
Yeah, I feel like that's a mistake that a lot of brand owners make, especially even when starting their business. They're like, man, I really love X product. Let me go sell it, right? Or they're yeah. just trying to think about, okay, well, I would buy this rather than actually surveying, like you were saying, the people that they're actually trying to sell to. And then instead of trying to, yeah. you know, try and be smart or whatever, like just be dumb and ask them what they want. You know what I mean? Like you don't have to reinvent the wheel. They're going to tell you exactly what they would buy from you. And then that really helps you
yeah.
build it around what people want rather than what you think people will want, because oftentimes it's not the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest mistakes people make is they think they know what mm-hmm. the market wants. And I heard this recently is like, there was a question posed to a content creator and it was like, do you want to do lo-fi content or hi-fi content? You know, this whole idea of like the quality yeah. of the content. And he goes, we're not arrogant enough to think that we know what the consumer will determine as high or low mm-hmm. quality. So we just put it out and we test. And oftentimes I think one of the biggest, challenges entrepreneurs have is they have a little bit of cognitive bias or hubris, if you will, to think that they know what the market yeah. wants. And maybe sometimes you get it right, but oftentimes you don't. And I think the more you can validate or invalidate assumptions based on community engagement or feedback from the actual people that are swiping their credit card, that's another thing that we learned is sometimes people are going to tell you shit that they want, but they don't actually buy it. Like, you know, the number of times we've said, hey guys, what other products do you want us to make? And they were like, we want hair shampoo and conditioner. We want body wash. We want lotion. And so we stock up on this entire body care line. And I got, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of inventory in the back, and like not very many people are buying the shit they said they uh-huh. wanted to buy, you know? So there is this balance of like, you want to take feedback and like try to apply it, but also what someone says they want and what they're willing to pay for oftentimes is a little bit different. And that's where as founders, right? Like the art and the science comes in, and we've got to make good judgment calls, strategic decisions, look at data, analyze things, and then ultimately be willing to make the wrong decision and fail so we can learn like which direction to take things. But I've always felt like I wasn't smart enough to know. So I'm just going to ask.
Exactly. And you guys have had a pretty wild ride. I mean, you even just mentioned there that you launched a whole body care and then it just ended up not working. What are some of like the biggest challenges that you guys have had so far?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you start as an entrepreneur, you don't know what you don't even know. And I think in that beginning, you're just going off of excitement and passion. You know, in the beginning, it was cash mm-hmm. flow. You know, how do we afford inventory? We were growing at, you know, 30, 40, 50% kind of, you know, year over year, quarter over quarter there for a bit. And it's like, man, we can't keep up with inventory. So that was a big constraint. And then we ran into a massive constraint with acquisition. Mm-hmm. You know, right after iOS stuff, 2021, 22, you know, all of a sudden everything broke and we had to figure out how to reinvent mm-hmm. ourselves. I think ultimately the one thing that, so in my previous businesses, the biggest challenge I had was I built them on one platform or one distribution channel. And so from the gate, I was like, I'm never going to make that mistake. So we tried to diversify our advertising sources, our traffic sources, our product sets. Most recently, the biggest challenge we've had is acquisition costs still, people for sure. And then, you know, I think product line extensions are always difficult. You've got to figure out, like the body care thing was interesting because we launched bar soap and it crushed. We launched deodorant and it did very mm-hmm. well. We launched hair shampoo and conditioner and it's like nobody buys it. But they said that they want it, you know? And so it's like, interesting. And then you run surveys and you try to figure it out. But I'd say the biggest friction points in the business have been definitely cash flow early on. Once we got terms and like built the reputation with our vendors, that helped. Then it was an acquisition issue. Okay, how do we build offers and funnels that will allow us to predictably acquire customers? Once we solved that, as advertising prices have risen, candidly, now we're having a little bit of an LTV mm-hmm. issue. Like, we've got a predictable funnel that's pulling people in with our sample. We've got a sample funnel that we use to give people an experience with the products, which we can talk about. But I don't have any problem acquiring people now, but now my LTV is lower because that first purchase order is only $10. It's a sample per pack. So getting that ascension is a big constraint for us right now. So now we're really zeroing in on that. All of this to say, I think the biggest problem most entrepreneurs have is actually identifying the true constraint in the business. Because there's always going to be a lot of fires and a lot of things that are important, but typically there's only a few things that are the bottleneck of the business in any one moment. And so, you know, I heard it said like the most efficient thing you can do is solve the right problem in the right mm-hmm. way. But oftentimes we're solving the wrong problem and also like solving it in the wrong way. And so I would just say a big challenge we've had is identifying what are the right problems along the way. Cause the first time you do it, you know, it's the worst time you do it. So you're trying to figure it out. But, most recently it's been people, you know. I think in the beginning, when you're an entrepreneur, like you really just want to make as much money yeah. as you can and get going. And then you get to a constraint of bandwidth and time and hours. And you're like, well, the only way this is going to grow beyond me is if I start hiring right. some people. And for me, I'd never done it before. So I just hired anybody that would work for me, you know, anybody that was like a good culture fit and then could do the role. And then I was like, well, I'll hire people and then I'll train them. And that was a good strategy in the beginning because I could pay them less because they didn't mm-hmm. have skills and train them up. But one of the things I learned is like, you're going to pay with time or mm-hmm. with money. And at a certain stage, you have to pay with time. But as an entrepreneur, you have to understand when that inflection point changes and you have to start paying with money. Because ultimately, the time that it takes someone to get up to speed is more expensive than a higher salary. And even if that's 2, 3, you know, 20, 30, 40% higher, that balance point. But I'd say people, you know, we just went through a restructuring a few months ago. And ultimately, I hired a bunch of people about 9 months ago to help take the company to the next level. And we just didn't do a good job hiring. Great people, just right, wrong seat, wrong skill set for that role. And I had to let multiple people go over the course of a couple of days. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, I take that as a personal right. failure. Like, I failed them. I didn't put them in a position to win. I didn't hire the right person. I wasn't clearly communicating what the expectations were. So that was very, very difficult. But on the other side of that, we now, 90 days later, have the strongest team we've ever had because we brought in some right people. We learned from those experiences. So I think money, inventory, people, advertising, like they've all been big, big issues along the way. And figuring out which one is the most important to solve is usually the most difficult because they all feel like they're urgent and important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you generally have to start top of the funnel down and see which part's breaking, but then something else breaks and then you got to go back up and figure out what the heck's going on. But I like the part that you're saying about kind of having that multi-channel acquisition. I mean, the biggest brands or the brands that we see that are the most successful are those brands that have kind of that, what I call kind of like that omnipresence approach to their marketing. Like they're mm-hmm. everywhere. And we deal with that type of education working in the SEO side of things because people are like, oh, I don't need SEO. It's like, well, actually, if you want to diversify and actually want to build your brand long-term, this is why SEO is important type thing. So I see that all the time. And then we see it very clearly when brands don't take that seriously, how quickly and easily it is for them to fail when something like a Facebook algorithm change and they require you to do more creatives, but they don't have a machine to be able to create that many creatives, you know? And yeah. then people, super, super important, especially if you don't have quality team members. Oftentimes, like you were saying, we'll just go straight for those people that seem like they're ready to work and they're the most in our face, but they're not always the best option. What qualities do you look for when you're looking for a team member?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think I kind of have a three like part hiring mm-hmm. process. So the first part is 100% about culture fit, right? And so we have a very particular culture that we operate by here. You know, and one of the things I kind of give this speech, especially in the world we live in today with the fuckery and the political correctness that I just don't subscribe to. So I say, you know, at Live Bearded, we are an environment where we like to agree to disagree. And I'm never going to censor anybody. I'm going to let anybody talk about whatever they want, whether it's sex, politics, or religion. This is an environment for adults. I say fuck an awful lot, and I'm never going to censor myself, and I'm never going to censor any of my employees. And I want you to understand what type of environment this is, because that's supportive to some and not to others. And if you don't feel like you're going to be able to thrive in an environment where we call each other out, call each other up, push each other, and ultimately have the ability to agree to disagree, then maybe this isn't the right fit for you. And no one says, oh no, that's the wrong fit, but they all bow out down the road, right? So when they're face to face, so it's like a filter. So first for me is culture above everything, and then they have to have the skills. So I do culture, then I do you have the capacity to fulfill the roles and responsibilities that are required for this position? If you do that, then I want to talk about your career goals and vision. Because ultimately, I don't want to hire someone that sees me as a stepping stone. I don't want to hire someone that's just, like, I interviewed this girl for a social media manager role. And she was in California. We flew her out here, spent a day showing her, introducing her to everybody, took her to lunch, and we were chatting. And she's, I was like, so, you know, why do you want to move to Arizona? She's like, well, I've always lived in California, and I just figured I'd want to come out here and try it for a couple of years.
Ooh, and I was like, wrong answer.
Amazing. Amazing. Like, I love that for you. And then we didn't extend her a job because she was just wanting to experiment it for a couple of years. But she said all of her family lived back there and she just wanted to try something different. Nothing against her, just that gave me the alignment to know that she wasn't aligned with where I wanted to go and where I wanted to take things. And of course, people are going to come and go. And I look at every business is a vehicle, and, you know, call it a bus. And there are some people that are going to get on at certain stops and off at others. And that's part of the process. And my job as an entrepreneur is to find the best people for the journey that we're going on today. And I also know that along the way, some of them are going to get off, some of them are going to have better opportunities, or some of them are going to be outgrown or outgrow or whatever that might be. But for me, I think anybody who's looking for people, you've got to be very, very serious about culture, number one, and then roles and responsibilities, number two. And then ultimately, you've got to find someone who's aligned with where you want to go. And I think as a founder, your job is to create a vision for the company that is big enough that your team's vision and ideas can fit within it. And if you can create that, then you can create an opportunity where people love what you do. They love being a part of the organization. And if you get the culture piece right, I mean, we just hired a new customer service rep, and she came into my office the other day and she said, I just want to let you know, I was at a family dinner last night and everyone said that they've never seen me this happy before. And they asked what's going on. She's like, honestly, it's just because I feel like I finally found my home and a place to work. And there's very few things in business that give you a better feeling than that. And, you know, one of the things that I think is so powerful, when you get the culture piece right and your internal team really feels supported, that bleeds over to your customers and your community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just maybe a week ago, we had a customer write in and he said, basically, the long story short was, this guy, his husband had just recently passed away. And his husband was a huge fan of Lip Bearded, loved our products. And he basically was like, I just wanted to reach out and let you know that, you know, so-and-so has passed away. And I just wanted to thank you for the support that you've given him over the years. He loved his beard. And you guys were one of the reasons why he felt more confident and more, you know, he felt good about himself, was the confidence from the grooming and the things and being part of the community. And I just remember we all shared it as a team, and we had this little, you know, we do a team stand-up meeting every Monday, and this idea of like, this guy just lost his husband and he's writing us a few days later to thank us for the impact that we had and how we helped him and his family like feel more confident and feel a part of a community. Like, that's priceless. And that creates ripple effects across the business that you cannot buy. You cannot spend any amount of money to get that type of referral or that type of affinity. And it starts with picking the right people and making sure that that culture exists. As a leader, you have to be the one that leads it, and then you have to train it, and then you have to, you know, basically allow that ripple effect to expand out through what you guys do. But culture, skills, and then vision, those are kind of how I look at it. And you know, I think based on the company and the values of the company, like the attributes or things like that, obviously are going to be that are going to change or maybe be different based on the company. But that would be how I approach the hiring process.
And then you kind of touched on this a little bit, but how do you get your team to see the vision not only of your company, but also like the brand and what you're trying to do in people's lives?
Yeah, I think there's a few things that we've done that have worked. You know, first off, you have to lead by example. So you can't be full of shit.
You got to have a nice beard.
You know, if we say really, exactly, right? So we have very strict rules. If you're a dude and you work at Live Bearded, you must have a beard. And if you're a woman, you must not. Like, it's pretty straightforward. No, but I think, you know, for me, leadership starts with you. Like, if you can lead yourself, then you earn the privilege and the opportunity to lead other people. And then the best leaders create other leaders. And so I think it really just starts with how you show up every day and then the way that you actually treat people. And so I define culture as like how you treat each other, how you handle conflict, and ultimately the experience that you get when you spend time together. So I'd say that's number one, getting really clear on that. And then we have a very transparent culture. So every month I show my company our P&L. And I've taught the different departments, hey, operations, you're in charge of fulfillment, you're in charge of inventory management, et cetera. So here's what our fulfillment expense was. It was 13.5% last month. That's higher than it normally is. Like, what happened in this department that shouldn't have happened? Or, hey guys, you crushed it. It was 12% last month. Like, you saved us 1.5 from the previous month. That added this amount to the bottom line. You guys fucking killed it. Amazing job. And so once a month, we go through a profit analysis in the business and I break down the P&L and like what happens in operations, what happens in marketing, what's taking place in customer service. There's a really incredible book I would highly recommend everybody read. It's called How to Double Your Profit in 6 Months or Less. And it's by this guy named Bob Pfeiffer. Now, I don't subscribe to all of his ideas because he was like this hard ass corporate M&A guy, like take over public companies, optimize the shit out of them, sell parts off, you know, to make revenue or to make profit. But he has some really actionable ideas. And that's the first place I heard of this idea of you need to create a profit culture. And then you need to let your team know that the company is creating profit, not to serve you as a founder, but to serve the company. And the more profit you have, the more you can reinvest back into the team. So, perfect, you know, a really simple example is like I'm a big fan of education. So I'm flying different people on my team to conferences, seminars. I'm always investing in it. And two of my customer service guys came to me and they said, hey, Gorgeous is holding this like 1 day event in LA for customer service teams. Can we go to it? And I said, you can go to it under one condition. You need to do three things. You have to write a report, or basically I have to do one thing. You have to write a report and say, what was your biggest takeaway? What can you apply in the business? And if applied, what's the impact that will have? And so they're like, awesome. They do it. They go to this thing. They come back. They're fucking fired up. They're super excited. You know, they're taking pictures on the airplane because customer service reps, let's be real. They probably don't have, you know, a huge salary. They're probably not traveling a lot. Right. And so for us to invest into them, they put together this presentation. They presented it to the leadership team about how, you know, they learned this and this. And if we do live chat at the cart here, if we make outbound calls here, we can increase this way, that way. They were totally bought in. And so empowering people to step up and to lead, or entrusting them, investing into them. And then ultimately just getting outside of the office. You know, we're in Arizona. It's super hot in the summer. So we take them out to the lake. We go rent a boat for the day. We go paddleboarding. We just once a quarter, we try to do something as a team. And that's just to have fun, just to, you know, be friends with each other in addition to colleagues. So there's a few things in there, but ultimately I think it starts at the top, and you've got to be who you say you are, and you've got to lead by example and create congruence and authenticity. And then the transparency part was huge for us. When people started to see like and understand the way that the mechanics of the business worked and the profit that we had and what that means and how that means we can invest back into them, that's when the buy-in started to become really exceptional.
Yeah, that conference thing, I feel like it's super slept on. I heard that for the first time, I think like a year ago, and we started doing it with our employees as well. And they get so inspired, like the same as you and I. Like when we go to an event, we have all these ideas. We feel like, man, I just met the most awesome people ever. this, that, whatever. And it's the same thing for your team. Like if you can help have them feel that experience, and especially like you and I, we maybe go to an event every single month. It might be the only one they do all year. And it's like their highlight of their year. And then it inspires them to start thinking of ideas. And then you're not the only one that needs to think of ideas. Your team is now helping you and pushing you forward in the innovation side.
Yeah, two things. If you're a founder and you want to grow a great business, you need people. And you don't need more hands. You need more brains. I think that's where a business really starts to get to the next level. I just hired a director of marketing, and I hired him probably 18 months too late. Me, I'm like a marketing guy by trade. I'm a CEO because I got good at marketing and I built a business. And I love marketing. So I was always in the weeds, rolling up my sleeves, tinkering with shit, running split tests. Like that's what I did. And so I invested resources in other areas of the business because I was like, oh, I can just handle more marketing load. But recently I hired a really incredible director of marketing. And the dude is like great. And now our marketing and the strategies that we have, everything is going to the next level because I have another big brain in the business. And just that ability to give people inspired thought, ideas, and then to contribute is powerful. And so, yeah, I would say everybody listening to this, you need to find a conference that you can send people on your team to like show them that you want to invest into them, to show them that you believe in them. And I did this, I've always done this, but I've never required them to do anything to go. And now I would say you have to require them to do something. And that's, for us, we like to keep it simple. You have to create a one-page report or a 3 or 4 page PowerPoint, and you have to answer 3 questions. And I already said them, but I'll repeat them. What was your biggest takeaways from the conference? How can you apply those in the business? And then the most important question is, if you applied them, what impact would they have? There could be an increase in revenue. It could be a decrease in cost. It could be an increase in customer engagement. But make them do the thinking to understand tangibly, what would this impact be? And now they've told you, and all you got to do is be like, bro, you can do this and create that. That's unbelievable. You're going to make that happen for the company. That's, oh, dude, you know, and now they're like, yeah, I did say that and I am going to do it. And then they go execute. And so you're not telling them what to do. They're telling you what the potential is, and you're inspiring them to follow through.
Absolutely. You said one of the most important lessons that you'd learned, you said this off camera, was that most of your mistakes came from short-term thinking. How do you avoid this mindset and shift it over to long-term?
It's such a great point, man. I think I grew up in the affiliate space, and so it's always chasing ROAS, you know, one day attribution. It was a really difficult transition for me. And ultimately, I think there wasn't any one thing that I did. It was just, for me, it was kind of over time changing my perspective on what I wanted to do. I think that one of the biggest problems we have in the entrepreneurial world, especially in the online D2C world, is this idea of scaling quickly. Let me make all this money really fast. And for sure, all of my biggest losses and mistakes have come from chasing quick results. And I think, I don't know that there's one way to overcome it. It's just a mindset. Yeah. And here's what I do know. Like, if you want to build a fucking skyscraper, you've got to dig very deep to build a strong foundation in order to go high. And so the bigger vision you have, the longer time horizon you have to have. I heard it said that all of our stress and anxiety comes from false time constraints. And so for me, you know, one of the things I realized is I'm really, really bad at overestimating what I can do. I just feel like I can always do more than I actually can. And so I end up overestimating what I can do in a day, a week, a month, or a year. But then I end up underestimating what I can do in 10 or 20 years. And so I think maybe the best way to overcome it is to sit back and say, how long do I want to play this game? Where do I want to be in 10, 20, 30 years from now? And you actually have to do the thinking of like, where do I want to be in 10, 20, 30 years from now? What type of business do I want to have? What type of life do I want to live? And then look at yourself and say, okay, well, if I had, instead of having 1 year to build the foundation of a business, what if you had 10 years, you know? And then also just like studying other people, you know, Warren Buffett didn't become a billionaire until he was like 60 years old. So for 30 years, you know, he got to the point of like, I think his net worth in his 50s was like 75 million. And then the next, you know, 20 years of his life, he became a multi-billionaire. And I literally have this painting on my wall right over here, and it's exponential growth. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 64, 128, 256, 512. It starts at 1, and 30 days later, it gets to 536 million. Mm-hmm. Just doubling it every day. So I think the natural disposition is to want things fast because that's everything that the world is telling us. But if you understand that the only way you're going to become fucking great is if you play the game for longer than everybody else. Yeah. I started a podcast recently, and one of the things that I read is like most podcasts never make it past like 9 episodes. And if you get to 20 episodes, you're in like the top 1% of all the podcasts that have ever been out there. People just don't play the game. So I think you got to, like, if you just want the outcome, you're probably not going to get there. One of my favorite sayings is the man who loves to run will run farther than the man that loves the destination. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I changed my thinking from outcome, money, fast to how do I become the best business owner I can be? How do I play this game for the next 10, 20 years of my life? How do I master? How do I love the process of running? And by doing that, it started to stretch my time horizon. And then the last thing I'll say on this is I want to have a marathon mindset with a sprinter's execution. Yeah. I want to show up every day with a sense of urgency, but I want to know that I'm going to play the game for the next 20 years. And so if you're trying to get started, if you just want to be in the game for the short term, I probably wouldn't even play it. But that would be how I think about it. And it's been a big, big, big challenge in my life. That's why I just ranted for 10 minutes because I fucking struggled with this for multiple
years. Yeah. And I think especially with this generation or even how everyone functions in business right now, social media has played like a huge negative effect on that of like showing all these people's success and how quickly it happened. And it's like, oh, and then you just get comparison paralysis and you're like, well, why aren't I like that person? I've been doing it for 2 years and blah, blah, blah. And even a lot of these people, they show like, oh, this is my success. And we think it looks quick, but then you learn their story and they've been doing it for 10 years. Right. And then all of a sudden it took off.
Yeah.
You know, so I think social media has played a huge negative effect on that, on a lot of people's minds, especially in like with drop shipping and all that kind of stuff of all these people that have made millions, but then you don't know that their profit margins were 99%. You know what I mean? So it's an unfortunate thing, but that comparison is really, like you were saying, it's really the biggest cause of anxiety. And even people, I would say even people giving up. Like you were saying, podcasts don't go past 20 episodes. Like they probably give up because in the first 9 episodes, they didn't get a lot of viewers.
They didn't go viral.
And they're like, oh, well, that's it. It's not going to work for me. And it's like, well, not entirely. Like how many, I don't even remember. I was listening to Joe Rogan the other day, and he obviously has a big podcast, but he was talking about like how he had like 300 episodes before people even like started watching him. I'm just like, what? That's wild. Like we all think that it was like this quick success, but not like that at all.
Yeah. Yeah. The only other thing that I might add to that as we're talking about it is like the biggest hack I've had in business is putting myself in rooms with people that were much smarter than me and just paying for access to conferences, rooms, masterminds. And the one thing that I started to notice about the people that were farther ahead than me is they'd been playing the game longer and more consistent. And so I think that's another thing too. It's easy to get inspired by the wrong people when you're on social media and you see the bullshit. It's really easy to get inspired by the right people when you get in a room with them and you learn that like, oh, that guy that grew his $25 million brand, like there might be 1 out of 100 that got there in an 18-month time frame, but the majority of them are going to be there in a 5, 8, 10 year time frame. You know, it's like, it just, there's always that exception that but I don't believe exceptions disprove the rule. And the rule is the longer you play the game, the greater your likelihood of success.
Yeah. And we get that complication with SEO all the time because people are like, oh, well, I don't want to do it because I'm not going to make millions tomorrow. And it's like, Yeah, but you will in 2 years, you know, and there it is. And it's that foundation, like you were saying. Like if you look at just like bamboo and how it grows, like the root grows of bamboo for 6 months before it shoots out. So when it has that time of growth, and then all of a sudden you're like, man, bamboo grows so fast or whatever. It's like, yeah, but it had 6 months of foundation before you saw it shoot up.
Yeah, I think the expectations that we have as entrepreneurs, I think oftentimes like significantly hinder us. You know, if like, again, I mentioned, I just started a podcast myself and I sat down, I'm like, what's the goal? And I was like, I'll see what the goal is in 100 episodes. Like, I'm not even going to measure, like the only thing I'm going to measure in the first year and a half, 2 years is my inputs. And like, if you're just focused on your inputs and you're focused on that input getting better every single time, over time, like you're going to get where you want to get to. And I think that expectation of X amount by X date is really difficult. And we got to obviously have a target to shoot at. But if you're playing the game, if you're running to run because you want to get great at it versus running to try to get to that set point, the expectation that we set for ourselves often is going to determine how difficult or exciting that journey is.
Yeah. And transitioning a little bit from mindset, wanted to get into a little bit of more of some specifics. So one of the competition got pretty fierce after the pandemic, especially in your guys's niche. How did you guys overcome that challenge?
Yeah, I think we doubled down on offer. We were like around that time, we were really struggling to predictably acquire a customer. And so we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what our kind of hero offer would be. And I think in e-commerce specific, previous to that, we were advertising just to the store, to collections. We were advertising different products, but we didn't have a singular focus. And for whatever reason, I was really nervous to put all of my advertising energy and focus on one particular product or one particular sales funnel, especially when we have, you know, multiple SKUs and lots of different things. But going and creating a funnel for one product, with us, we have fragranced items. So one of the biggest friction points is what's it going to smell like and does it work for me? And so we created a sample pack, $10, and then once you buy it, we'll give you a $10 credit. We auto apply it to your account using Shopify Plus to come back and repurchase. So you essentially get the sample of the products for free. So we architected and built out this funnel, created some good ad creative, and the offer just took off. And we went from, you know, 50, 75 new customers a day to 200, 300, 400 new customers a day pretty quickly, just by kind of getting that front end offer correct. And so for me, I think when things get competitive, you have to just figure out how you can make a better offer or how you can reposition your products in a way to understand, well, to meet the customer where they are. I think so that would be number one is offer. And then last year, so middle of 23, we were really struggling again. Same offer, but we couldn't get our acquisition cost had went, you know, $30, $35, even $40. And for a $10 product, you know, we're losing a substantial amount on that first purchase at that time. It wasn't financially viable for us. And I hired a consultant, a buddy of mine who's been doing marketing for a long time. And he said, you know, I think maybe the biggest problem you guys have right now is your positioning is a little all over the place. And so we ran a series of Facebook ads that literally just tested, like the image was just the exact same, but all it had was different headlines. And in the headlines, all we were calling out was different keywords that we thought the customer might click on. Are you embarrassed by your beard? Are you dissatisfied with your beard? Does your beard suck? Can you not grow the beard that you want? Are you just, you know, like all these different things. And ultimately, we were trying to figure out what language did we need to position our brand in a way that was meeting the customer where they were at versus just kind of talking in more generic terms. And so, we ran a bunch of tests around pain point, and then we ran a bunch of tests around benefit solution. And ultimately, we took the winners of both of those, combined them together, and then we wrote a video script. And it started out, it's like there's three guys in a bar, and they're all employees of mine at the time. And one of the guys is like, "Ah, my beard sucks," and then the other dude just like bitch slaps him, and is like, "Your beard doesn't suck. You suck at taking care of it." And it's like, yeah, man, you got blah, blah, blah. And then they go into kind of the whole thing, right? And we found that in our market, a lot of guys were discouraged or dissatisfied or embarrassed was the biggest click-through, like the highest click-through percentage was on embarrassed. Oh, guys are embarrassed by their beard. Okay. Well, if you're embarrassed by your beard, you probably think your beard sucks. And so we use that and the bitch slap in the bar setting to kind of call out this idea of like, hey, stop being a bitch. Like, just take care of it and it will grow and it will be great. And that became one of our best performing ads for a period of time and broke our acquisition. We literally went from $35 in a CPA back down to like $18 with that piece of ad creative. So for me, it's always two things. If we're struggling to acquire customers, it's how do I create a more compelling offer, right? And figuring out what's that friction point that the customer is feeling and stopping them from buying. And then once the offer works, it's going to fatigue at some point in time. So then you're going to have to figure out other ways to position it in a way that can meet your customer where they are. And that's where I think using things like headline testing and different surveys and things, you can get the customer to tell you exactly what positioning they're going to click on the most. And that allowed us to kind of unlock the next level of growth in the business.
So my problem is my beard grows too fast. How do I solve that problem?
You know what, bro? I think most guys that are going to hear that are going to be like, man, fuck this dude. Like, damn, I wish we all had that problem. I got nothing for you on
that. Yeah, no, it's ridiculous, but it's all good. People always, yeah, like you said, most people get mad when I tell them that, especially if they can't grow a beard. Yeah.
But no, I think just to wrap that up though, it's like you need a better offer or you need to figure out better positioning. And ultimately, one of the things we've learned is problem is a much better selling point than solution. So how can you frame things as a pain point or as a problem?
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of going into that a little bit more, how did you guys identify kind of those gaps? I mean, I know that you said you tested some ads here and there to see what people were clicking on and what they weren't clicking on, but how did you identify some of those gaps in the market when everyone was all of a sudden selling, you know, beard accessories?
Yeah. I think it just goes back to surveying the clients. You know, we had, you know, we just send a message out to our customer base or people that maybe have bought once but never bought again. So we segment our customers and then we send out messages. I think so that's one way that we would do it. And then just figure out what are the right questions to ask to try to lead them to some type of an answer that's going to help us. So that's one way to do it. And then I mentioned culture and hiring the right people. I got a team of 15 bearded dudes. So it's usually working from your own perspective is a bad idea. But because I have a team of a lot of our ideal customer in this office, I feel like we have a unique advantage. So we can sit down and say, hey, like, where are we coming up short? Where are we missing the mark? What can we do here? What gaps can we fill? And we're kind of constantly having that conversation of like, are we meeting them where they are? I think the best way to influence someone is to make them feel seen, heard, and understood. And so how can we do that through content, through messaging, through marketing? So I always start with the customer first, and then I do some internal surveying and we'll do some workshop meetings and things like that.
Yeah. And you guys do have like an incredibly loyal audience. What are some of the strategies that you guys use to build your brand into this cult-like following?
It really did start with getting clear on what the culture was and how we wanted to treat people. As cliche as it is, like, I don't think there's a silver bullet for culture and building a loyal following. I think it's doing the unscalable. So I'll give you an actual example, and then I'll talk a little bit more theory. We do product launches. Yeah. So we have seasonal fragrances, and we only sell them in a kit just simply for inventory purposes. We have 5,000 kits. Once they're gone, they're gone. Somehow a customer like found an a la carte URL inside of Shopify and he ordered like 10 a la carte beard oils. And warehouse saw it. They're like, hey, this order looks weird. They sent a message to customer service and my guy in customer service just canceled the order and refunded it. Didn't reach out to the customer, right? The customer reached out to us and got pissed. And actually he found my email and sent me a personal email. And was like, hey, Anthony, I just want to let you know, like, I love your product and I love your company, but I think it's really shitty what you guys did to me. And I was really excited to try this product. And I didn't realize that I was doing something that I wasn't supposed to do. And he was like kind of upset about it. I screenshotted the product. I sent it to my customer service team. And I said, hey, guys, can you guys tell me what happened here and how do we resolve this? My customer service rep's like, that's on me. I did that. That's my bad. He literally calls him up, says, you know, hey, blah, blah, blah. Hey, brother, I'm sorry. Like, I should have reached out to you. He apologized. He owned the mistake. We sent him the order. We did some additional things on top of that, went above and beyond to take care of it because it was a fuck up on our behalf. And we treated that guy so well. He emailed me back and said, hey, I actually have a business trip in Phoenix. Can I buy pizza for your team? I know that there was a mistake, but the way that you guys handled it was so incredible that I want to come by and meet you guys and say thank you. So it's owning our shit. It's admitting when we're wrong. It's treating every customer like a human and ultimately always going above and beyond to do the right thing. And I think there's so many opportunities when like I'm cautious to say it, but I kind of love it when we fuck up. Because it gives us an opportunity to own the mistake and then to over-deliver. And so, like, that's a silly example. One time I was writing emails. I was building out a three-day kind of flash sale campaign. Yeah. It's like Wednesday night. It's like 9 p.m. I'm kind of tired. Instead of hitting schedule, I hit send on the fucking email. And it was like the last email of the last day. So it was like, sale ends in a few hours. This is your last chance. And then all of a sudden, like two guys from my team ping me on Slack and they're like, bro, what the fuck are you doing? And I was like, oh shit. So I was like, okay, how, like it already sent. There's nothing I can do. What do I do in this moment? I go, you know what? Fuck it. I pull up another email. I'm like, hey guys, this is Mink. As you guys know, we're running a sale this weekend. My dumbass was in the process of like setting up the email campaigns for the weekend. And instead of hitting schedule, I hit send. That's on me. Sorry. If you guys want to make fun of me, the person who roasts me the hardest gets a free kit on the house. And I send that email out. And dude, we got hundreds of replies from people. And it was like, Mink finishes too early. He like premature, you know, ejaculation. Like it was all of these funny things. And I literally turned the whole thing into a blog post.
That's hilarious.
And it's still on our website today. So the takeaway there is the way that we've built a really loyal following is just by being good dudes and just being fun, down to earth, and treating our customers the way that we would want to be treated as a customer. And again, it's like cliche, but that's the way that we've done it. And we've done that consistently for 8 years. And that's how we've acquired, you know, like you said in the beginning, 65,000 five-star reviews, this cult-like following. So that's the application of it. The theory of it is we got really clear on how we wanted to show up as a brand, like what our values are and ultimately who we want to serve. And so we built our entire company on a single idea. Spencer and I had been friends for 10 years when we started the company. And we had this idea that was like, what if we treated every customer the way we would treat a friend if we were friends for 10 years? Like if I was to buy something from Spencer, how would he treat me? Okay, we're going to have a 365-day money back guarantee. We're going to make all of our products in America because that's super important to us. We're going to make all natural products because that's important to us. But more than that, like we're just going to always do the right thing. And if we fuck up, we're going to own it and we're going to do whatever we can to fix that mistake. And I think at first people are like, "Yeah, I've heard this bullshit before." But then they have an experience and then over time and then the reputation starts to expand. And then you just get known for that. But it's the one-off situations where you wow one person because of a situation that arose that you really be, you know, and then you stack those over time. You think, oh, it's just one person. It doesn't matter. But like my warehouse team will come to me and they'll be like, hey, they'll know customers' names now because they order so much and they just see it time and time again. And they'll look it up and be like, dude, this is this guy's 25th order. Can we do something special? And I'm like, yeah. Whatever, like they write him a handwritten note, thank you, blah, blah, blah. And then they give him some free shit or whatever. And that doesn't happen every day, but it happens once or twice a week. Because
the culture you build.
And again, you just do that over time. So I think that's how you build that super loyal cult following. And then also, again, like I would say we're a very patriotic, made in America, man, masculine driven brand. And so we just lean very hard into what we believe. And we don't, you know, we're not super polarizing in the sense that we get into politics or religion or sex. Like, we stay in our lane with beards, but we stand for fucking men. And we believe what we believe, and we will never shy away from our values. And I think guys see that, and they really rally behind it. And then as it relates to hiring, this is a little tangent, but in every job posting, I put like, these are our values, whatever it takes, actions greater than words, freedom. And I have like little descriptors. And one of the qualifying questions I ask everybody who applies is, why would you want to work for LiveBearded? Mm-hmm. And unanimously, most people are like, the values of the company. I love the values that you guys stand for. So it's the values that create the internal culture, and it's living by the values that create the external loyalty and cult-like following.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I know you call it unscalable, but I mean, you've obviously proven that it's very scalable to do it that way. But I think it goes back once again to that long-term versus short-term mindset, like treating everyone as an individual and actually caring about people and listening to them. Like, that's not a short-term strategy. That's not something that's going to scale you into eight figures in 1 year. Like, it's going to take time, but it builds that foundation for what you want to actually get to. And one of the things that I always say is that to be an entrepreneur, you kind of have to be addicted to failing. Like you were saying, I mean, it sounds weird, but it's like, you have to love failure, because if you shy away from failure, if failure affects you too much, then you're never going to take risks, and you're never going to make any mistakes or even own those mistakes because you're so afraid of them. You know,
I 100% agree. And I would even say it this way, the entrepreneurs that we admire the most have failed more than anyone else. And if you just understand that, like Elon, Richard Branson, Jeff Bezos, like these fucking guys have failed more than anyone else. And that's why they are who they are. Well, that should inspire you to get off your ass and just go fail forward.
Absolutely. So I wanted to dive more into the marketing side of things. But before I do that, I know one of the things that you talked about is like the quality of your product and wanting to make things in the US and stuff, and all these different kinds of things that you guys are trying to approach with your mission and vision. I know that originally you started off in more of somewhat of a, like a drop shipping model, but how have you maintained and even improved the quality of your product and consistency as the business has grown?
I think it's just constant and never ending improvement. So the first few products we had, we bought them internationally. Then we worked with a local manufacturer, found one guy, got the most simple, you know, like minimum viable product made we could, put it in the marketplace. And again, it's like, you know, post-purchase surveys. What do you like about the product? What do you not like about the product? And I would say every 2 to 3 years, we've had a pretty significant product line in update or upgrade, whether that was like through new formulas, new packaging, but we're always trying to use the product ourselves, refine the product, and improve upon it. And we just did our Q3 planning session yesterday. One of our main initiatives is we're tweaking our beard oil formula a little bit. We're going to add another ingredient into it to try to improve the quality of the formula. We're redesigning and improving our beard wash formula. And so I think I just have this idea that the product is never done. There's always something that you can learn and improve. There's, you know, new ingredients, new things that come out. So I think you got to find a really good manufacturing partner, which we have. We've got a few of them, but we have one core. And you just got to tell them, look, we're going to always try to get better. And we want to hear from you guys how we can improve. And we want to hear from our customers how we can improve. So it's just knowing that the work there is never done and taking that customer feedback to heart and implementing what.
Has it ever backfired when you've updated like the ingredients for a product and it's either been horrible or people didn't like it?
I'll tell you, you asked me the pain point question. Here's a massive one. The first manufacturer we went with, I'd never worked with a manufacturer. So I had no contracts, no formulas, no nothing. And we had a handshake deal. And after about 2.5 years with him, everything was breaking and he couldn't scale with us. And so we were trying to get our formulas from him to go to a larger manufacturer. And he basically told us to fuck off. So we had to reformulate our entire brand at year 4. from the ground up. It took us about 18 months. And so all new formulas, all new packaging, all new labels. So we kind of like built it into like a Live Bearded 2.0. But when we relaunched, there was one of our products, we ended up taking it from a 4 ounce to a 3 ounce. Just logistically speaking, it made more sense. We didn't reduce the price. And the consistency, that's our beard butter. So the consistency of it was very different. We thought it was a lot better, but ultimately it was very different than our original one. And then also the fragrances that this guy had made, he wouldn't give us. So we had to recreate all of our fragrances and to try to match them. So that whole process, it was like an 18-month, two-year process. And when we relaunched, I would say it was 90% positive. But, you know, there's always these people, they just get so attached to certain things or they don't want anything to change. And so we got a lot of negative feedback on a 4 ounce product going to a 3 ounce. So they're getting less for the same price. Fragrances changed. How dare you? You know, one of the things that we've done is we've retired fragrances that don't sell well. And so we position it as we're retiring that and introducing something new. And, you know, people get pissed. There's, even though it's maybe one of our lower selling products, you know, there's a few hundred maybe or whatever that's their favorite. And you just piss them off. And then they get, you know, they get upset with you. They yell at you. They leave. So I think that's always going to happen. There's going to be a cohort of people that never want anything to change. And I think we've just, like, we never want to deliberately piss someone off, but we also understand that the nature of business is growth and change. And so it's going to happen. You just have to try to mitigate it, the downside, as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. And then one of the things that you mentioned also off camera was one of the things or the challenges that you had was financial forecast and staying focused on some critical tasks in the business. So how, especially... new brand owners or maybe medium-sized brand owners, like how do you incorporate financial forecasting and what is important in that topic for you specifically or lessons you've learned?
The language of business is accounting. Mm-hmm. And if you can't speak the language, then you don't know how to play the game. I think a lot of really smart marketers or hustlers get into business and they're able to grow it. But at the end of the day, when they don't understand a P&L or where expenses are going or how things are done, it makes it very difficult to actually build something sustainable. Mm-hmm. And if you want to build a sustainable long-term business, you have to have a very, very good understanding of the financials of the business. You know, for us in the beginning, it was just, well, what are we going to do next year? How do we forecast inventory? Like, well, how do we forecast sales? And then figuring that out and then figuring out like how much you could spend on marketing. And so it was really just kind of sitting down and reverse engineering what our expense ratios were. You know, how much is going to be in G&A, is going to be in labor, is going to be in IT, is going to be in sales and marketing? Where are the different categories of the business and how do we look at those from a percentage basis and budget them for a year? Is that even possible? In the beginning, I had no idea how to do this. And so I reached out to people that were smarter than me. And I had a buddy that had sold a couple companies and he gave me his forecasting tool. And he's like, hey, just fill this in. This is the most important thing, you know? And then you read some books, you go to some mastermind groups. But in the beginning, I had no fucking clue what I was doing. And I remember the very first forecast I put together, it was like, okay, in the first year, we're going to do like 1.5 million and then 10 million and then 40.
That's the dream. That's the dream.
And, dude, it was like it made complete sense to me. Like, of course, this is what's going to happen. And
in a perfect world.
Needless to say, it was, you know, complete and utter bullshit. But I think when it comes to forecasting, I think in the beginning, you just make shit up. And then once you get data, then you can baseline it off of data. So now, you know, we have our dashboards built out, and honestly, I'm happy to create a copy of them and share them if it's valuable, because I didn't have it in the beginning and someone originally gave me mine. So, but you know, we look at the way that we forecast now is based on acquisition frequency and AOV. And I'm sure you're familiar, but if you take total number of acquisition times total number of times they're going to purchase times AOV, that's what your store revenue is going to be. And so we'll sit down as a leadership team and say, okay, over the next year, our acquisition was X last year. what growth factor do we think we can add? Can we grow 5%, 10%, 20%? And we do that for frequency and we do that for AOV. And at the end of the day, you back out based on some historical data and then potential future activities or strategic growth points that you have where you can end up. And then we use that to kind of backfill everything. And we've worked with a good accounting firm. I hired an accounting firm in like Q4 of 2016, and we launched our website in Q3 of 2016. Mm-hmm. So from the get-go, I was like, I know I need to have some data. And early on, it was just give me a monthly management report, you know? And then after a few years, it was like, I get daily P&Ls, daily cash flow balances, and I get a 13-week cash flow analysis as well. So in the beginning, you just got to have a directionally correct understanding of where money is going and how it's flowing. And then as the business gets bigger, you need to be more sophisticated with tools and resources. I couldn't run a business now without the financial optics that we
have. Especially just once you're able to see things and just tweak small numbers here and there. And then you'll notice, like, especially when you're at scale, the exponential growth it'll have. Like, oh man, my AOV went down 2% this month and it impacted our revenue by a million. You know what I mean? Like, being able to even do the opposite and say like, hey, if we just increase our AOV by 1%, we'll make a million more this year. It's like, wow, that's all it will take. So going in more into those numbers and stuff, I know that you guys mentioned there's an AOV complication. What are some of the things that you guys have done to increase your AOV?
Yeah, so our main acquisition funnel is a $10 funnel. So obviously out of the gate, that's going to cause a really big acquisition or AOV issue. Obviously cross-sells and upsells are really big for us. The biggest thing that we've done is seasonal launches and specific bundle kits. So we'll create higher AOV products and then we'll do promotional periods with those. So I know that that first purchase order value is going to be low. I've got a couple of immediate cross-sells and upsells to just try to bump it as high as I can to subsidize the CAC in the beginning. But then beyond that, everything we're pushing towards is a higher AOV type of product. And so with our seasonal fragrances, you know, it's a limited quantity. So we sell them only in kits and we sell them at a 10% premium and then we sell out. You know, we did a big Father's Day sale. So we're not running one for 4th of July in a couple of days. But what we do when we don't want to run a site-wide sale is we build a special kit. So now we have the 4th of July kit. You know, when we market that, maybe we have a couple of them. One's a $70 and one's $100. Well, our AOV is typically around $45. So if we can get one that's 50 to 100% higher and we can drive the revenue to that by increasing the savings. So that's typically how we do it. But, you know, we use, I mentioned I'm good friends with Ezra. So we use his app Zipify for cross-sell, upsell stuff. And lots of dynamic split testing there to try to figure out what products are going to get the highest upsell rate, drive revenue per purchase up, and then just work the math and launch higher AOV products down the
floor. And then for retargeting, you obviously email ads and stuff too. What strategies are you think are working the best right now for being able to retarget those kit buyers, the $10 kit buyers?
Yeah, I'll start with ads. That seems like such a black hole to me because I talk to one person and they're like, oh, retargeting is dead. You talk to another person and they're like, oh, well, yeah, I'm retargeting across our entire website and social and everything. So I don't fucking know. What I do know is the way that we do retargeting on Facebook is actually by frequency. Okay. And if you look, like we have one campaign and it's usually broad, and then we might have a couple of other broader audience targets. We do run if we're doing a sales promotion for call it 4 or 5 days, we do spin up a classic retargeting audience with just past customers, past engagers, et cetera. But we don't run that all of the time. And so just during normal day-to-day operations, if you log into Facebook and you look, you'll have some ads where the frequency is like one, and then you'll have some where it's 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, even though it's targeting a broad audience. And so from an advertising standpoint, we're looking at those higher frequency ads as more of a retargeting play. And Facebook is basically saying, hey, this ad, for whatever reason, is getting shown to more people that have already seen it before. And so that on the ad side, that's how we do it. We have a Google search account, and then we have a YouTube account, and we run those two separate. And so YouTube for us is pretty much all top of funnel. And then our secondary Google account is pretty much all display, all search and retargeting. So we've actually broke those out into two different categories. And then from email, I mean, we make 45-ish percent of our revenue from email. And it's primarily because we have a seasonal launch strategy where we're launching new products at a consistent cadence. So we do 4 new fragrances a year, Father's Day, an anniversary sale, and then obviously the massive Black Friday, Cyber Monday push. So that obviously really helps for all the retargeting stuff. We have SMS, we have postcards. You talk about brand loyalty. My customer service team, they just sit out right outside my office. They call any customer who has spent $300 with us and thank them for their purchase. And so we have a loyalty program, different tiers. $300 spend is the highest tier. So they're conditioned every day. They call them up, you know, and anywhere, you know, any day there might be anywhere from like 25 to 50 mm-hmm. people that have graduated from below to above 300. Call them up, leave them a voicemail. Thank you so much. If you're here, you need anything. So that's a touch point. Ringless voicemail is a touch point. If you've never done any ringless voicemail, it's a super interesting tool. Yeah. But I had every one of my customer service reps record a ringless voicemail, and then they send them out in rotation. So one day we send out a ringless voicemail from Jeremy. The next day it's from Kane. The next day it's from, you know, someone else. And so it's in a rotation. It's never the same, but it's getting touch points. Postcards, we do postcards as well. So we've built as many touch points into the retargeting funnel mm-hmm. as possible, even down to product inserts, you know, and this kind of ties into cult following and loyalty, but you know, those Livestrong bracelets that were really popular back in the day, we make those and give them away for free in all of our orders. And they have our values on them, like do better, live bearded, whatever it takes, freedom, etc. We have little sticker packs. We toss those in. Because we fulfill all of our own orders, we've got custom inserts. Sometimes it's products. Sometimes it's discounts. So we've basically stepped back and said, what's every potential touch point with our customer throughout the entire customer journey? And then once they're post-purchase, how do we get in front of them as many times mm-hmm. as possible? And not even post-purchase, but like after they've engaged our ecosystem, how do we get in touch with them at every standpoint? So we've been very intentional with it, and I don't really know any other ways that we can try to get in touch with them outside of just going up and knocking on their fucking door.
Yeah, exactly. Do you guys use any of those softwares that collect people's info after they visited your page? I've heard of a few of them.
So like retention.com and OpenSend and things like that. Someone goes to the website, you don't have their data, but they have the data, and then they give you the data, they sell you the lead. That's actually on my Q3 plan. I've heard people talking about it. Some of our competitors have been featured with case studies. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Again, I've heard mixed reviews. We haven't implemented it. It's on my list of things to implement. The other thing that's on my list to implement, which is a retargeting play, there's a company called Maverick, and you record a video. Hey, you know, hey, Zach, thanks so much for buying from Live Bearded, da 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 da. You upload that to Maverick, and now they use AI to insert the order's name. And so like every single person could get a personalized video from me or from
That's awesome.
I didn't do it for a long time because I was like, no one is going to believe that I recorded a fucking video and for everyone, right? But I mean, the data that they present is pretty compelling in terms of like open rate, click-through rate, excitement around it. So I figured what's the harm in giving it a try? That's one we're going to look to install and try this quarter as
well. Maybe making it more believable would be like for people that spend over a certain amount. Like, hey, I saw that you spent $100. Then maybe they'd be like, it'd be a little bit more believable that you did it.
You know what? That's actually a really great idea because I just told you how we call customers that spend $300. So we could call them. And then we could send him an email as well. That could be really interesting.
Yeah. OpenSend, we use it with a lot of our clients, and we've seen it be quite profitable. I'm actually good friends with Eddie Malouf. So he's the one who talked me into using it with them, and it's great. I love it a lot. So no complaints there.
I was told that I should not under any circumstances send from my dedicated domain through Klaviyo. Do you guys use a different ESP to send so you don't hurt your reputation?
So yes and no. So you could do a couple different things. You can do that where you send from a different domain or a subdomain. So it could even be something like email.livebearded.com, like it come from that type of thing, mm-hmm. or it can just be a different segmentation inside your Klaviyo. So we'll have people try see how engaging these audiences are, and they'll the first email will literally be like, "Hey, saw you hopped on my website. Are you interested in my products?" And then literally having them reply, and then if they reply, moving them into a correct audience. And if they don't reply, just see you later, never talking to you again type thing, so that they don't ruin that reputation.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. It's something I really want to test as well. So I love that you guys are doing it. Now you've got me a little extra incentive to make it happen.
Yeah. What are some other marketing kind of levers that you guys are, that are pulling to see some of those growth, that growth in sales, whether it's platforms or, you know, TikTok, whatever it is?
Because we just did our quarterly planning session yesterday, our biggest problem right now is the LTV of our particular sample buyers. And just being super transparent, right? $10 AOV in the beginning reduces the lifetime value pretty substantially. So our LTV to CAC ratio is much lower than I want it to be. So our biggest focus right now is, again, on optimizing that customer journey once they have purchased to drive LTV rates. So one of the things that we're going to do is a different customized insert into that. We're going to actually phone call people at day 30 if they haven't come back and purchased. And it's going to be positioned as a customer, like, just question. Hey, Zach, I noticed you bought the sample kit. Just wanted to touch base and see how you liked it, man. What was your favorite fragrance? Oh, that's awesome, man. You loved the Legend. That's great. I also noticed you haven't used your $10 coupon code yet. Would you like me to like get a Legend queued up for you and place and take care of your order right now so I can get it out the door to you? So just like finding optimization points in the funnel, I think is super interesting. We haven't done anything with TikTok Shop. It's definitely high on our priority list. And, you know, as much as we've had this really incredible community, one of the things we haven't got right is like a really good ambassador and or affiliate program. And so I'm working, that's one of my big focuses in quarter three, is to actually get our ambassador program built out and launched. When I look at a lot of companies that have grown very profitably, like I did a call with the founder of Bucked Up, and Bucked Up is just an unbelievable supplement company. I mean, they've blown up, and he told me some of their numbers, and it was impressive what they've done. And a big driver of that was their ambassador program and just taking that cult following that you have and then giving them a proper incentive to really share on your behalf. And so that's a big focus of ours as well. So I'd say the biggest marketing initiatives are the ambassador program, building that out. I looked at a couple of different softwares. I haven't tested it yet because I'm in the development process of it, but we're using GetRoster. GetRoster.com has been super interesting so far. So we're going to launch with their software, and they do a bunch of cool things, from different ambassador tiers, different promotions, giveaways, things like that. The TikTok Shop, I mean, everybody's talking about it. We just haven't done anything with it yet. And then a lot of the LTV optimization stuff on the sample, that's like my entire focus for the rest of the year. And then also we're already thinking about Black Friday, Cyber Monday. And the last 2 years, our offer has been a free gift with purchase. Mm-hmm. So 20% off. And then if you spend X amount, you're going to get this free gift. So we're working on trying to figure out what that is. And even looking at maybe a bigger giveaway, mm-hmm. I'm sure you're familiar with like the Diesel Brothers and Van Oaks. He's a legend in some of this stuff. And so that big giveaway model, we're talking about maybe doing a big giveaway and kind of pairing that with Black Friday, Cyber Monday to drive the overall excitement of shopping with us when everybody's running a sale and your kind of primary desire is to try to stand out from
the others. Exactly. Yeah. And that was going to be kind of my wrapping up question is, as far as trends go and how you see the market evolving, what are some of the things? I mean, I know you mentioned some things that you guys are planning and initiating now, but what are some of the ways that you see, D2C in general evolving, and how are you planning on addressing those?
Yeah, fuck, man. That's a great question. I feel like we're at this inflection point where the data would suggest that this is probably one of the toughest years in mm-hmm. e-commerce. And I say that because I gave a presentation at Ezra's Blue Ribbon Mastermind earlier this year. And the year over year, or excuse me, the quarter over quarter growth in e-commerce is the lowest it's ever been over the last four quarters in the history of them tracking it. It was like 10%, 15%, 20%. During COVID, it was like 50%, 60%. And then over the last four quarters, it's been like 7%, 8%. So there's a little bit of growth there, but it's just flat in comparison to what it has been. And then obviously the cookie data, pixel data fuckery that we're losing, all the privacy issues, targeting stuff. One of the areas where I feel really behind is a lot of the AI. We haven't done a lot with it. I'm getting hit up every day by companies that are like, this AI language model is going to do all of your marketing for you and aggregate customers. And so I don't even know what I don't know when it comes to that, but I feel like that is definitely going to have a big play in the future of D2C and how we optimize. I think brands are going to have to get better at marketing and be less reliant on attribution. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to have to really think about it. We made the transition from a channel attribution strategy to more of a MER across the company strategy, maybe like a year ago. And we still do, we have Triple Whale and we still do look at platform attribution data and make some decisions. But the bigger decision is, hey, we want to spend 20% on ad spend. And are we hitting that number day to day? And are we too high, or where are we driving? So I think, I don't know what the super tactical things are. I'm not a lot in the weeds anymore, but I think there's going to continue to be issues of getting in front of the right people. And so we're going to have to figure out ways to do that. I think AI is likely going to fill that gap in some capacity. I don't know what company it's going to be or how it's going to evolve. And the one thing I know for sure is you can't replace giving someone a direct experience. 100%. And if you can get someone on the phone, if you can get something physical into their hands, if you can, you know, we're doing every year we do a charity 5K. We invite our customers out. We do kind of a pre-party at our office. So the biggest focus we have is just creating experiences for customer, whether it's in the digital world or on the phone or in person. I know if we have that relationship with someone, they're always going to want to buy from us. And so I think it's going to be more about the reputation that you have as a brand and then what other people are saying about you that's going to help you bridge that gap in the data loss.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. That's awesome. As kind of a last question, one of the things that I always ask founders is, what would be your piece of advice to two different audiences? So the first audience is beginners. They're just trying to get started in there with their brand, fighting it out, finding the products, all that kind of stuff. And then what would be your piece of advice to brands that, you know, want to go from somewhere around like 7 to 8 figures and want to really scale what they have kind of that product market fit on already?
Yeah. So the guy that's just getting started, that's very easy. This is going to be the hardest fucking thing you ever did. It's going to be way harder than you think it is. And you have to have a long-term vision like we talked about. But what's going to make or break your success is your ability to focus. And I think, you know, Hormozi talks about this as good as anybody. And he's like, you can get to, you know, $500,000 to $1 million a month really easily on just one channel, whether that's just Facebook or that's just Google or that's just YouTube, just TikTok. So I would say whatever, if you're just getting started, whatever channel you have the most experience with or you're most interested in, go all in on that one channel. Focus all of your energy and effort on building real relationships and connecting with an actual audience of people and finding ways that you can serve them. And if you like writing, then write a newsletter or go to Twitter. If you like creating videos, then maybe TikTok or Reels or whatever it is. But I would say it's going to be really, really fucking hard. If you want fast money, just don't even get started. And two, find one channel that you can commit to and just go all in on that channel. And that will give you the ability to get to that seven-figure mark. Once you're at the seven-figure mark, you've got to start thinking about how you can buy back some of your time. There's going to be so many things that start to happen, especially around, for me, it was around 5 million. Like all the way up to 5 million, I could manage everything. Like between 5 and 7, everything started to break for me because I was being pulled in way too many different directions. And if you want to go from 7 figures to 8, it's all about the team. And it is unbelievable the value that one great person can bring to the organization, both in contribution of ideas, but in effort and in just a general fun to be around. You know, totally, I've seen our culture totally evolve when we had different personalities come in, and you, it just takes on a whole life of its own. So zero to that seven-figure mark, it's about laser focused and just gutting it out and grinding through it and staying focused on one channel. And then seven to eight figures for us, it's been about diversifying channels, getting a couple, two, three channels going, taking what was working on one, putting it in one or two other channels, and then bringing on really exceptional people that can carry some of the load.
That's awesome. Awesome. Well, Anthony, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. I know it's valuable, so I appreciate you coming and providing value to the people listening. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, bro, it's been a pleasure. I love having these conversations, and I love what you're doing out there. I love the opportunity to connect, and I appreciate you having me on. And if anybody wants to connect or wants to ask mm-hmm. anything about my business at Live Bearded, you know, my Instagram is just at Anthony Mink, and you guys can hit me up and shoot me a message.
Please.
Anytime. I'd love to connect and support any way that I can.
And then you mentioned you had a podcast as well, and obviously educating some people. Where can they find some of those education pieces or that podcast?
Yeah. So the podcast is called Entitled to Nothing. I believe our life is our fault. And so that's mostly just like a mindset kind of, you know, leadership style podcast. Mm-hmm. We do interview some business guys, but that's on Spotify, Apple. You can just type in Entitled to Nothing. And then anthonymink.com has everything. So if you want to follow me on social or get connected to the podcast, anthonymink.com is where everything is.
Beautiful. Beautiful, my man. Well, thank you so much. Thank you guys all for listening. My name is Zach Schubert. Once again, done 120 million D2C e-commerce from organic Google. And this is all about finding quality founders, people that have had an excellent experience, that have been able to overcome the biggest barriers in their business, and getting advice from them. So if you enjoy hearing this, if you are an e-commerce founder, I look forward to seeing you on the next episode. Thank you guys so much. And thank you again, Anthony.